Welcome to week three of whatever the name of this podcast is that we haven't decided yet. I want to call it Stand Up, Sits Down, but apparently that's a copyright issue.
Oh, really? Okay.
So we have to call it Probe. Scott Capurro Probes is the name of the show now. Not my idea. Anyway, so welcome. And as I mentioned in the past, I find it interesting to ask performers, writers, politicians, people who think and then express their ideas publicly or make a lot of noise at the doors that are coming into the recording studio.
That people door's always been like that.
Do that again. Anyway, people who do that, who perform live, I like to ask them, you know, what inspires them to do what they do. I think it makes what they do more reachable, more interesting, and it adds a certain layer to what they're presenting. I've been working with stand-up comics so far. We were lucky enough in the first week to work with Andrew Doyle, who, as my current guest said, oh, that guy who talks about free speech and then kicks people out of his show. Yeah, it was Andrew Doyle. And last week we had Leo Kirst, who was banned from a club he played in Australia after they'd hired him because he told a joke that they knew about. Anyway, and other things they were talking about, not just comics who, you know, have been banned or gotten in trouble, but someone like this week's guest, Omid Jalili, a fabulous broadcaster, producer, documentary filmmaker, stand-up comic, actor, and all-around great guy who's just, you said...
Well, can I just truncate to describe me?
Yes, go ahead.
I am a fat, needy man pleading for attention.
But then you've just described most of the stand-up comics on the circuit, so they'll be like, oh, that guy. Anyway, you're jolly, not fat. Fat's just such a, you know...
Yes, I'm fat-shaming myself. That's
yeah, you are,
right.
You're fat-shaming. It's okay to do it to yourself, though.
Yes.
I'm feeling bloated. Thank you for not mentioning it. And it's all the medication. But anyway, thank you for coming here. We really appreciate it.
I'm a big fan of yours. Have been for many, many years. 25 years now.
Oh, Jesus. Good luck.
I've been aware of you.
How long have you been on the circuit? Or doing comedy? Because you're not really on the circuit.
I think as long as you have. I think I was aware of you in 94 at the Edinburgh Festival. I was doing kind of one-man shows, and I started doing stand-up around 95. So probably a little bit after you.
Now, why did you jump? When you say one-man show, do you mean an hour-long?
It was hour-long
stand-up.
Theatre shows, one-man shows. I was studying, I studied theatre, and I actually was working in the former Czechoslovakia doing very bizarre experimental theatre, stuff I didn't even understand.
If you're going to do it, that's the place to do it, though, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, do you know what? If you're going to do it, I'll do a bit for you.
Okay.
The first thing I ever did was, and I didn't understand what it was. They said, just do it, everyone will understand. And it was black stage, tight pin spot on a goldfish being lowered by a string from the top of the stage. And there's a cello silently playing one note at the back. And it comes to ground level, lights come up, and I've got a Magnum 44. And I go click, and there's an explosive device makes the goldfish explode. And then I shout at the top of my voice, Lenin. And there's a blackout, and there was a standing ovation.
Of course there was.
Yes.
Of course.
That's the kind of stuff I was doing.
It still isn't a blackout, the standing ovation, but I'm sure it was. What were you wearing? Black tights.
I was wearing all black, yes.
Of course. What was that?
I like that's the first question you asked. Well, what were you wearing?
What was that meant to, was it the end of a proper?
It was the end of communism.
Communism, yeah, they wanted it to go away. They wanted it to go away? Or
Yes, this was 1991. A year
right
after
before the country broke up. Yeah,
about a year and a bit after the Velvet Revolution.
Right. A lot of people I knew who live in places like Montenegro or Croatia, because I still do that bit that you described. I'm still on that circuit, and it's a dolphin
but you know,
now.
I have to tell you, I did a Netflix series in Prague, and Prague is a bit like Paris in the 1920s now. You know, in the night they had like Picasso was there and Jean Cocteau, and there's a whole collection of American and British and French artists who've gathered in Prague, and they're all there now, and it's an amazing creative hub right now.
Yeah, and a great witness protection program city too. So meet a lot of guys with New York accents named Rainbow. But when I first started as well.
Yeah.
I mean, not the kind of erudite, expressionistic, intellectual stuff you're talking about. I was, you know, like the lead in Anything Goes. But anyway, Anything Goes. I was a tap dancing, singing homosexual.
Really?
I know you can't find those anymore, can you? They're really hard. Yes, I studied, I took a year of ballet.
I think I remember telling you on the last podcast that when people said to me, where did we get that terrible stereotype that, you know, if you see a gay person, you know, backs to the walls, you're going to get bummed. And it was your act, basically. It was you talking to the front row. That was what was generating.
I'm ground zero of that. I am. I started that. That's my trick. No, you know, oh, well, I was so used to working in the theater, like you just described,
yes.
And so used to people, everybody getting it, nobody caring,
yeah.
That when I started doing stand-up, and I started doing it maybe for the reason you did, I don't know at the time, I just wanted a bit more control over my work and my expression. And when I started doing it, I thought, oh, everyone will get it because in theater everyone gets it. But stand-up and theater, those audiences are
completely different. Yeah.
How do you describe, you know...
And did you enjoy having the control of your work?
I enjoyed not auditioning. I was always too tall, not tall enough, too young, too old. I was always something that wasn't that part.
But you were a trained dancer and singer.
I was, yeah, and I was and constructed because of my height, really, not anything else, as a leading man. Difficult for a character actor to be 6'2". And so I did that in community theater, and I did it, you know, all that stuff. But I just found like, I just thought, I'm not going to. I didn't have the vocal range to do anything more than that. Right. And then I was funny in rehearsal. And so many people were like, oh, you should try stand-up. And I'm like, oh, I tried it in L.A. And I was closeted and I hated it. And they're like, oh, no, it's different now. You'll be fine. You know who you are now. You seem more confident. And I don't know. It just seemed a stand-up audience seemed... I liked the intimacy of it. I liked making eye contact with them. But you're in a position now. You started on the circuit the way I did. But you're playing Royal Command performances now in huge rooms. Do you feel like that intimacy that you shared with an audience maybe 25 years ago, do you feel like you're still able to obtain that when you talk to them?
Yes, you can, because I still do the circuit. I still, like, I'm here tonight doing some shows.
We're at the Top Secret Comedy Club,
which is two fantastic spaces where you can do your set and then make the adjustments if something's gone wrong straight away when you come upstairs. So I always like the honesty of stand-up, because I come from theater, and then I got together with Ivor Dembina and we did something called The Arab and the Jew, which was in response to Yitzhak Rabin being shot in November of 1995. Let's do an Arab Jewish thing, like a double act. And I remember doing remember the Meccano Club in Islington?
Yeah.
And I remember doing a new material night they used to have on a Wednesday night, and it was Andre Vincent came up to us and said, first gag was great, middle bit was rubbish. And then there's a bit, the penultimate joke was great, that don't end with the last bit. And I remember thinking, oh, he's being so honest. Usually people just say, like, you've done it again, or amazing.
Yeah.
But I love the immediacy, because we're all so damaged. Everyone is damaged in comedy. Mm. But the way we connected was through visceral honesty.
Yeah.
And I like that. And that was, I think, missing in my life. And I gravitated towards comedians and the stand-up comedy world, because it was just more authentic and honest.
When you say damaged, do you mean that comics are seeking something on stage?
I have wounds from my childhood the size of Alaska, and I need people to validate me through laughter.
You sound like Sarah Palin. So when you say that, she has something the size of Alaska. But when you say that, do you mean that you are on stage trying to work through them?
Well, I'll tell you something. I think I always had a problem being a British Iranian, because I did a one-man show.
Uh-huh.
And then I got this review by a guy called Jack Tinker, who was the Daily Mail writer, who was a very respected writer, now passed away. And he said, oh, I felt very happy and very engaged in his offbeat outsider's, you know, perspective, because he's an outsider and it was very nice to be. And I remember thinking, my God, I was born here. How far in the country do I have to be to not be considered an outsider?
Well, you do sometimes mention your ethnicity in your act, and sometimes you open with it. I'm going to play a bit of who you
are. Oh, my God, he's looking through his phone.
And then we'll talk about that a little. This is a set. Oddly, you've gotten in trouble. Let's talk about the pink unicorn in the room. You got in trouble recently with the Welsh.
Yes.
For a tweet.
Just a tweet, yes.
About the Welsh language.
It's so funny.
Shall I read it, what you said on
Yes,
on the tweet?
Read the tweet. And it's a picture caption. So there's a caption of a road sign, which are mostly in Welsh and English. And this particular one was of the Botanic Gardens.
Right.
And I don't know if you can even... I tried to pronounce the name to a Welsh friend and I was stuttering.
I can't do it because I'm educated, but I'll read what you said. You said, there are worse things than being Welsh, dyslexic, and having a terrible stutter, but not many.
Yes.
That was your response to that sign. And you print on the sign, which is hilarious. And some Welsh people got uppity about it, didn't they? They kind of went after
they
you. And
did.
It's still a news story, by the way. It's still traveling around the
social media.
It's still
a news
media.
Story.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the BBC News website, which has 10 million Twitter followers,
yes.
said that I had angered people. I think it's because all my life I've made, because I love culture and love, I come from a background where I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Baha'i. And the Baha'is believe the earth is one country, mankind is citizens. So I embrace all cultures and I love doing Nigerian accents. I kind of somehow get away with that. I shouldn't. I love doing Arabic accents in my act. And so I've always thought it was a given that where my comedy comes from a good place.
Yeah.
And the tweet came about because I was in Treorchy, which is a small village. And I'd made fun of the fact that the name of the theatre was called the Park and Dare Theatre. I said, the Park and Dare, you don't have much faith in your parking security here. I said, mind you, I went to a restaurant called the Eat and Shit Your Brains Out Bistro. So it seems to be
a chain of Wales, actually.
It's a chain.
Yeah.
It's a chain in Wales. So I did a whole, and I did lots of jokes about the famous people from that town, which one person was Clive Thomas, who was a soccer fan, is a big name for me. Clive Thomas was a Welsh referee who at the 1978 World Cup disallowed a goal. Someone took a corner, and as the Brazilians headed the ball in, he blew the whistle for full time before the ball went in. But with a corner, you should let the play finish. But
right.
the ball was in the air, and he blew whistle. And I said, it's interesting, that guy's Clive Thomas, the referee, and your local hospital is called the George Thomas Hospital. Thank God it wasn't called the Clive Thomas Hospital, because if you're having a kidney transplant, the minute they lifted the kidney and they're about to put it in, someone blows for full time. And they were laughing at all this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
it was
all
fun, and I was making fun of the Welsh. So when I was reading this sign, I said, how do you say this? Teach me Welsh. And they said, it's like this. And I was stuttering. And then the guy goes, you don't have dyslexia as well, do you? And I thought, that could be a funny tweet.
So I
sent it. I said, do you think this would upset people? He goes, it's funny. If we've got anything in Wales, it's a sense of humor. I sent it. And it had all this outrage, but I wouldn't apologize. And I wouldn't. And I think I responded to a couple of people, to always try and keep it light. But I refused to apologize because I thought you can do this tweet about any language.
Yeah.
Like the Basque language is very, very complicated in the world, and the Spanish don't understand it.
Right.
So I could say there are many worse things. There are things that are worse than being Basque dyslexic and having a stutter, but not many. And I don't think, because they said, how would you feel if we made fun of your language? And I said, we wouldn't be offended at all. In fact, we'd be happy for people to know something about the Arabic language or the Persian language. So I didn't understand. I still won't refuse. I still refuse to because the thing I got, and this is where I did a bit of stand-up about it, and it didn't get a laugh, unfortunately, was that because you don't understand. It's the English people who've been making fun of us for years, and they're trying to exterminate our language and our culture. So we're not angry with you. We're just tired of all the jokes because it's an English thing. And I said, well, what happened in 2016? You all went, what's Brexit? Because it's an English idea. Or we'll vote for that then. And they didn't like
that. They sat in silence about that one.
They didn't like that one at all.
It's
and they were saying, well, that's the English people in Wales who are voting Brexit. Most Welsh speakers voted Remain. So anyway, the thing is, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Unless
if you're fucking kids.
Yeah. But that's hard to recover from.
Sorry,
by this.
You can cut that bit. I'm sorry.
That's not going to come next, is it? Oh, that's the next.
Let me say that again.
The next tweet on BBC.
There is no such thing as bad publicity unless, you know, you're a paedophile. Jimmy Savile.
Yeah.
But I do think.
Although it's kept his dream alive because we're still talking about him, right? Dead for a long time. Yeah.
But I just think that I know that there's a free speech issue going on, and I've always been very careful with what I say, but I've just always thought that my comedy comes from a good place, so come on, guys.
Well, let's play something. The reason I thought it was strange was because you did this bit in 2008 about accents and language. Let's play it, and it didn't cause any outrage at all. It is this.
Apparently people have had strokes, and they've woken up with a different accent. There was actually a Geordie woman who woke up with a Jamaican accent. It's absolutely true. She woke up, and they said, how are you feeling? She went, easy, no. And when she heard her accent, because how do you feel? She goes, I'm totally devastated.
I mean, for that bit, you didn't get in trouble at all. And like you said, you somehow got away with doing a Nigerian accent, and that didn't bother people.
Or a Jamaican accent.
You somehow get away with doing a Jamaican accent, and that didn't bother people. Do you think, what I'm asking you is, that was 2008. Yeah. Do you think audiences and their responses have altered in any way?
I think so, a little bit. I think things do change in 10 years. And like, for example, in Britain, we're very sensitive to racism. Hmm. And they say, you can't really talk about Iranians unless you're an Iranian. You can't really talk about women having, you know, a veil or not, unless you're a Middle Easterner or a future prime minister. So there is this sense that we've become very, very sensitive to that issue. Mm. And I think that's changed a little bit. And I know that I'm aware of that. So I've been trying to be a bit more careful in general with where the comedy comes from.
But you have this great joke where you say, in 1979, I temporarily changed my name from Omid Jalili, Iranian Baha'i, to Chico Andolini, Italian Catholic, to save face in the playground.
Yes.
Which is a great joke. Did you get in trouble when you told that?
No, I didn't get in trouble at all. I do know that whenever, like, for example, when 9/11 happened, there was my Iranian side said, well, 9/11's got nothing to do with me. It's got Osama bin Laden is Saudi. The attackers were Saudi, and they were trained in Afghanistan. Yeah. But my British side says, Jalili, what kind of name is that? Explain yourself. So I felt I had to explain everything about the Middle East. I took on the whole Middle East. So it's a weird thing that happened to me. And I think I was very much influenced by a very subtle sense of guilt that the British culture gives you. So I was an Iranian living in Britain feeling guilty about 9/11, which had nothing to do with me. So I felt I had to do stand-up.
Did 9/11 add some sort of gravitas, the experience itself, to the jokes you were telling?
Yes.
What I'm saying is, you could tell the same jokes after you told before, but they took on a different sort of weight. Is that true?
It's a very interesting question. I just won the Time Out Comedy Award. Me and Lee Mack had won, he'd won for Best Performance and I'd won for Best Stand-Up in 2001. That was February 2001. And what they do is Time Out put you up at the Bloomsbury Theatre. So there's no monetary prize, but you get these two shows at the Bloomsbury Theatre, and you can.
And Time Out magazine in those days was a huge.
Time Out magazine. We had Malcolm Hay.
We
did Malcolm Hay Day. That's when I remember seeing you did this incredible set. I don't know if you remember that set, but you were incredible. It's the first time I saw you do a set that had nothing to do with being San Franciscan or gay or anything. It was just a very, very visceral political set, and I remember thinking, this guy is
out of his
awesome. Mind. He's out of his mind. No, go back to doing gay jokes. But the Time Out was a big deal. So, and I remember we put posters up, and the show was sold out, and then 9/11 happened. Mm. And I had a phone call from Nigel, my manager, saying on September 12th, saying, you know, the gig you've got September 13th, that's gone. The corporate on the 15th is gone. The two comedy clubs you had 17th and 18th, they've gone. In fact, all you've got left now, your whole diary has gone. You've just got these two gigs at the Bloomsbury. And I said, are you kidding me? He goes, no, they've all gone. And I said, wow, well, should we get rid of those? He goes, no, we're going to keep them, but we'll change the posters because the posters around town. I like to put joke posters like burly but surprisingly athletic. And one was a Middle Eastern madman. Middle Eastern madman, the Scotsman. So we took all these posters down.
Yeah.
And then I did the show and I wrote 20 minutes of material about it because I felt my career was over.
About 9/11 or about your gigs being pulled or both?
About everything. About how I'm not a terrorist, and yet just being from the region was enough to have my career cancelled. My career was cancelled. I mean, it was the most extraordinary thing.
Were these
thing
gigs
ever.
At clubs with friends of yours running them and
yes.
people you knew well? And
yes, there were not anyone I know now, but there were gigs like in Huddersfield and gigs. I mean, they're like circuit gigs, but they just said it's not the right time. And then they say a corporate gig, we don't feel it's appropriate to be doing comedy right now, so the gig is cancelled.
Well, that's fair enough.
That's what I was told, and then I hear the gig went ahead.
Oh, right.
And they just booked Julian Clary, or they booked Jack D or someone
right,
else.
Right,
so
right.
So I was cancelled, and I felt the shows at the Bloomsbury were my chance to make a stand. So I did the shows at the Bloomsbury, and reviewers came down, and I think it kind of saved my career because I had to explain who I was. And I think the first joke was 9/11's happened and I'm making a stand because people of Middle Eastern background, Sikh people have been killed in New York. They've got nothing to do with it. So I'm making a stand. I'm moving ahead, and I want you all to know that my real name is Sven. I'm from Malmö in Göteborg. I'm from Sweden, Göteborg, Hedläget. And I did a whole 5 minutes in Swedish. So it was a way of salvaging the remnants of my career. But it was very scary at that time because people, neighbors looked at me in a different way. And it was so shocking what happened tonight. Because we thought, when 9/11 happened, we thought Britain was next. So I remember driving home that day and looking up in the skies, thinking there was going to be planes crashing in West London. So it was a scary time, and I understand the reaction, but just because I had a weird name and I was from the Middle East, that was, I thought, extremely unfair.
But you're not from the Middle East. You're from the UK.
I was born and raised in the UK. I have Iranian heritage.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a Muslim. I'm a Baha'i, which is a very, very inclusive faith. You know. Yeah. So in a sense, it was my British angst and guilt that made me...
That saved you.
That actually saved me, yeah.
Exactly. What about 7/7? How did people react after that?
I'd already dealt with 9/11.
That was the July 7th attack, by the way, here in London.
Yes,
yeah.
And that because there was a tremendous owning of that by London itself.
Yeah.
Because 9/11 was New York. When it happened in London, the whole of London pulled together we were one race. And it became a multicultural kind of, we're all in it together. And that didn't affect me as much. They still cancelled a couple of gigs. they just didn't think it was right. Just a couple.
But it's going to punish you a little bit.
Just to punish me a little bit, exactly. Yeah. But it was, it didn't affect me as much.
No, yeah, I watched your Royal Command performance in front of Charles for his 70th birthday last year.
Oh, you saw that, yes.
Fantastic, by the way.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
You know, I've been watching a lot of your stand-up over the last... I've seen you live many times and been watching a lot of your videos. And I just spent Sunday with Barbara Streisand in Hyde Park.
Oh, my God. How was that?
A bit gay. And it was also a gay pride in London. Oh, my God. Jesus.
Oh, my God.
I was going to get polio being there. But anyway, it was great. She was fantastic. I mean, I'd seen her 25 years before with my mother, which is also the gayest story I've ever just told. And I didn't know what to expect. I'd heard reviews, blah, 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 that she'd lost her voice. Anyway, she sounds fantastic. Yeah. She did 2 hours. She did three encores. She was fantastic.
Wow.
And I would say any performer, she's an inspiration to watch, to see how she molds the show, how she's funny now, how she's casual, calm on stage. She screwed up lyrics to Evergreen.
No.
And did Don't Rain on My Parade, and then made fun of herself. And then, you know, and then Chris Christopherson came out and sang together, I cried. And then Lionel Richie, hello, it's a wax museum, it's fantastic. And but I watched her and I thought, you know, this is someone who started performing in front of 7 people in Brooklyn, and now she's performing in front of 65,000, and it's not that different from the way you... Well, you have too. And I watched you at that Royal Command performance, and I have to say, it was the most relaxed I've ever seen you on camera.
I really was, yes.
And I'm like, this for me would be the most tense. You're performing in front of the royals.
Yeah.
You have to be so careful nowadays. This is just last year about what you say.
Yes.
And you're meant to be funny as well.
I know.
And
difficult.
You speak of your ethnic heritage in this country. There's a lot of walls you have to jump over and hoops you have to jump through to make Prince Charles laugh, who's not the easiest audience member.
No.
Either. And you floored him 3 times in 5 minutes. I was seriously impressed.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
Scott,
I'm a performer, I can imagine maybe how that this.
Yes.
Why does that room relax you so much? Why do you think you perform better in front of it in that situation?
No, because I just thought there's nothing to gain, everything to lose with a gig like this, because I've done those things before. 10 years before, I did a quite risky... I opened with a risky joke. I said, I've done the
Royal... In front of who?
In front of Prince Charles. I said, I've
done... 10 years before that.
Yeah, it was for his 60th birthday party. And I said, I've done the Royal Variety Performance 3 times now. And every time Prince Charles has been here. Now, to me, that's not variety. Get me a King Carlos of Spain. Give me someone else. Why is this guy? Get a life. I said, why is he always following me around? And so the fact that he had asked me personally to do the show, because you don't get paid, and you don't, there's everything to lose in those things. It's a very stiff audience. They hadn't laughed too much at the comedy that was on. They'd enjoyed the
did
magic.
Did you enjoy the comedy that had been on, or they just didn't get it?
I had, actually. Some of the comics were very funny, and they just weren't laughing. And it was a tough gig. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to do this, and I'll just go home and forget about it. But it was very nice, because...
You owned it.
Did I?
Yes.
Wow.
The pacing was perfect. You didn't seem nervous at all. you seemed as though you and Charles were good friends. And the joke you told at the end of your set.
Yeah, about him.
Yes. Where the pretense was that the people you were talking to didn't know who you were, and you interpret them as not knowing who Charles was.
Yes, exactly.
So you introduced Prince Charles.
And also
to
the
them.
Fact that he does talk to his plants all
yes,
the time.
Does. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I have a bit of history with them because they always, like, they want a joke or something. They'll call me up, like, he'll have it. I'm not sure if I should say this, but, and maybe we, let me tell you this, and if it's too much, we might have to cut it, but I'll tell you the joke. Uh-huh. He has a butler called Michael Fawcett who will call up and say, Prince needs a joke, and it's for architecture, and we need 10 jokes. Emailed tomorrow. So I think, okay, I don't have any jokes. And so I'll call up a couple of circuit comedians. Anyone got some architect jokes? It's for the Prince Charles. So people like Ian Stone, Boothby.
Sure, yeah.
Everyone chucks in a few jokes. I wrote a couple of jokes, send them off. And then he came back, said, yes. He goes, we do like this one joke that Prince likes architecture, but he won't write a book about it because he doesn't want to be known as the architect formerly known as Prince. And I said, okay. He goes, can you come to the palace and train him? I said, I'm in Birmingham
now. Are they paying you for all this?
No, because I'm in Birmingham now. They go, it's all right, we'll send a car. I said, no, I have a show. He goes, well, it's 4:00. What time's your show? I said, 7:30. He goes, we'll send a helicopter. What are your coordinates? And I said, what am I, a brigadier? There's no coordinates. He goes, no, we need you to come here and train him. And I said, I can't. So I have history with these people. And,
yeah.
And then I did... This is so funny. I did his private thing for his workforce, which is in December, which is a month after that thing you do. It's at Clarence House, and it's for his workforce. And I looked up the number of his workforce. It's 118.3. So I asked his butler, I said, what's the 0.3? He goes, oh, that's just, people who are part-time, they don't get paid, and there's no real point to their job. I said, who would that be? They went, that's you. So... when I finished, Prince Charles said, thank you very much to Point Three. That's my nickname. They go, Point Three. We need to do, and they call me up and call me Point Three. That is
it's like
my
James Bond. It's like you're 007.
007, but I'm Point Three. Isn't that ridiculous? So there's a little bit of history with these people, but I do know also that they have a great sense of humor. So I felt a bit relaxed that even if I go off piste with the Brexit bit, he'll appreciate it.
Yes, of course. Well, I'm going to play just a bit from that performance.
I got the worst heckle I've ever had in my life above a pub in Willesden Green. I just tried out a new joke. They got nothing. And in the silence in the corner, I audibly heard someone say, there used to be a pool table in here. It's not even a heckle, just a wistful reminder of a happier time.
That's your opening gambit, which I thought was great because... the audience had just heard you yell at them, and then you told a very relaxing... It just has very nice pace and a nice up-and-downness to it.
Yes, it was, yeah. It was very relaxed. But it was... what I did is I did another joke before that to get them on side. It was a very self-deprecating warm-up joke, which isn't a brilliant joke at all.
Right.
It was just about that. I'm much happy being in a theatre than a cinema. I was in the cinema today, and I just got so... angry. This, people were just kept, they just kept. I said, would you shut up? Would you just stop it? Get out! I threw them out. I said, get out! I said, they talked all the way throughout my phone call, which was just it's not a great joke, but it was just something because they'd seen magic before.
Oh, right.
So I just tried to tune. What happens in those audience, you've got to tune their brains back to stand up.
Well, you don't have much time, do you, really?
You don't. So I just thought I'd do a quick, like a fluffer joke. It's basically here's, we're going to do something different.
But then
so,
you talked about your ethnic heritage, and I wanted to play that joke too.
I mean, literally, just yesterday, I went into a New York diner. Because I was attracted by the sign on the door that said, we offer the authentic American experience. And they wouldn't let me in. Very realistic. Very realistic.
That's actually based on some truth. I was very upset because when Trump became president, I had just finished my American work visa. And we got a call from Larry David for me to do 2 episodes of season 9, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And they said, do you have your visa? I said, it was just run out, but it's okay, I'll get it. They says, no, you're filming in 5 weeks. You're never going to do it. And I said, no, hang on. I've got visas in 4 weeks. They said, there's no way. There's such a backup. You won't even get your visa in 11 weeks. You won't get it. So I lost a job. And then I was doing the New York Comedy Festival. And I said, well, I'll get my visa anyway. And it took 13 weeks.
Really?
And then I didn't get my visa on time. And then they said, look, just come in on the ESTA, but don't say you're working here. So then that's when the next joke came up that I said, I'm ethnically Iranian, but born and raised in the UK, which technically makes me Ukrainian. Then that joke came about because I was actually not granted a visa in time. And that was 13 weeks.
But you have a British passport.
I have a British. This is the point. And this is what happens to anyone. If you have an ethnic minority background, they do double checks. It takes a bit longer.
All right.
But even if you are British, like if Helen Mirren, her visa, and they wanted a job, it would take her 7 or 8 weeks to get it as well. So it's not an easy thing. It's a difficulty for everyone, but worse if you have, you know, Iranian background.
Right. And do you visit Iran?
No.
Have you been there?
When I was a kid, three and six.
So it's not stamped in your passport?
No,
they don't see
not
you
at all.
All right. They just see your name and think.
I was there more than 30 years ago. They asked me. They said I was there 1971.
Right.
But it's still, there's a delay. It's amazing.
Is your family supportive of what you do? Your parents?
Yeah, my parents didn't really see me do. My father passed away a couple of years ago. He was only supportive when he came to the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh, and it was an extra show. And he just kept looking around, and he was jotting things down. And I said, "So, what do you think of the show?" He said, "There's 1,000 people here, and you're getting this much. How much are you getting?" And I said, "What net?" He goes, "Yeah, I just want to know." And I told him. He goes, "Wow, this is a great job."
But you've been in huge feature films, though. You've been in blockbusters.
Yes.
Usually that impresses people.
It does, yeah. But it impresses people more if you can hold an audience for more than an hour in a big 1,000-seat venue. Yeah, that's when my dad got very impressed.
Do you think, is there anything about your career in Hollywood and here in film that you feel like you have to restrict your subject matter on stage? Because you're... In a way, you're not. I don't mean you're representing an ethnic community in Hollywood, but Hollywood, L.A. film they're touchy, especially right now, about subject matter like the Me Too movement, about the way women are treated in film, about equal pay, subject matter that could be something you wind up in your comedy act.
Yes.
If you write a joke, do you double think it because you think, well, I'm in film and I've got to be careful?
No, not at all. Not at all. I would never. If there's a view or a belief that I have, I will see it through to its end. I won't care because of a Hollywood career. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I produced a film called We Are Many, which was about the anti-war demonstrations of 2015. And it might have had, some of the other producers were very left-leaning, and it might be that some people were not so interested in using me more because they thought it's a political film. And it wasn't really. It was really. It was a film about humanity.
Yeah.
And I think maybe there was a perception that I was a political comedian. But I'm as political as the Chuckle Brothers. I don't think I'm. I don't take myself seriously at all. So no, I don't really. I don't censor myself.
I guess your ethnicity makes you to some people immediately a political act.
I suppose so. But I never. I never think. Oh, I might not get this role or something. No, never. Do you?
I think that. People worry that I split a room, and oh, sorry, what's going on? And so when my name might come up for a TV gig, I've been told by my management that producers shudder at the thought of putting me before camera sometimes because they're worried about what I might say. But the truth is, I do, you know, I do morning TV, I do morning radio in the States. I think I know the difference between a live audience and how to perform, how to behave. And anyway, everything's edited now anyway and rehearsed.
We're old enough now to be authentic. And I actually remember when I went for the audition with the film The Mummy, it was such a... I'll never forget it because it was 3 pages and I had one thing to say on each page. So they said, let's read the script. And I waited. I said this one word. Then I waited. I said that word. And I said that. They said, okay, can we do it again? And this time... And I went, whoa. Sorry, Stephen, are you giving me
Stephen.
Notes? Stephen Summers, the director. Yeah. He was there and he was going to give me notes. And I said, sorry, one second. Are you going to give me notes? And he said, yeah. And I said, how can you give me notes when I haven't said anything? And he started laughing. He goes, well, what do you think? And I said, listen, this is, I know you've written this, but it's pretty one-dimensional. At a push, I can make this two-dimensional if you want. He goes, no, we're looking for Rifki from Midnight Express, which is a big film in the 1980s. I said, we've seen that before. Why don't we play him for laughs? I said, do you know what? Let's forget this. So I just started talking to him, and he started laughing. And then he goes, okay, that's enough, that's fine. And then when I left the room, they said, what are you doing between April and September? I said, why? Because I think they want you. We've seen 65 people for this role. And I said, well, I've got two gigs at the Meccano Club. I refuse.
I'll be playing on Sawdust.
Yes, I really didn't want to cancel them. Yeah, yeah. And I never forget the first check I got from Universal Studios. It said, for two missed comedy gigs, it just said Meccano, £120. So they bought me out. And I was more proud of that than any
that
other salary
so
I got.
Funny.
But I remember thinking that was the first time I stood up, because I didn't know much about it. I'd done some theatre, but I just laughed when I thought he was going to give me notes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was an authentic reaction. So yeah. I've always been guided by having authentic reactions. And after that, he rang me. I was living in Hounslow in a housing association place. He goes, hey, Ahmed, this is Stephen Summers. I'm calling from LA. Just want to say, that was great what you did. And if you can just keep improvising, 9 times out of 10, I'll say no. But I just want to have a thick skin. Don't be like an actor and say, oh, my God, he didn't like it. Just take it and say, forget. But the one time, I'll use it as my script. I'll take the credit. So that was a very good thing he did, because then I just kept improvising.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all the time he goes, no, that's terrible. No, don't do that. Don't do that. And then he goes, okay, that's good. And they use those little bits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I developed something. I made that character two-dimensional.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm very proud.
I think part of the reason I was able... like you say, to get a couple of film roles when I started in acting was because I didn't mind speaking without a script in my hand.
Yes.
Because I was a stand-up, and so many roles that were offered to actors then, the smaller parts, like the ones I was getting,
had nothing.
Like
there.
You said, nothing. And so when I went for Doubtfire, they're like, they didn't have my character hadn't been scripted yet. They knew kind of what they wanted, but they
what
just...
What about Star Wars? Didn't you have it?
Hadn't been
you
scripted
and Greg
yet. Yeah, Greg did most of that. Almost all that improvisation was his idea. But yeah, they didn't have... They just knew... They just threw details at you and said, okay, go. And I remember feeling like that I'm fine with. The minute they stick a script in my hand, I start to get a bit tense. I start to kind of... And I know that some actors, they can't move without one, without something in their palm. But I think that's what makes... you know, comics are a bit lucky that way, because we can kind of jump in and jump out of stuff.
And we have
thick
skin.
Personally.
Yeah. We have thick skin. If someone said, Scott, that was terrible, I'll laugh and go, okay, let's do it.
I'd be the first person to agree, believe me. Last night, at the Comedy Store, they yelled out a suggestion for the improv show. I did 3 jokes on that suggestion, and they booed me off after their suggestion. How many jokes do you have about the diplomatic relationship between North and South Korea? Not many, I bet. I've got 3. And they all
booed
got
you
laughs.
Off.
Threatened, they booed me
But
off.
They all got laughs.
Yes, they did. God damn it.
How pissed off. We get so pissed off.
So
if you get a laugh and still get booed off, it's the worst thing for a comedian.
But in the end, it's like you said, it's better to be booed off than ignored. So is comedy, is it a necessity for you? Because you keep going back to circuit clubs to kind of perfect your own jokes. If you don't do it for a while, do you start to feel like a part of you is sort of dormant?
Yeah.
Or dying.
It atrophies. Yeah, yeah. It's a muscle that gets terrible atrophy. I mean, have you not done a gig? Have you ever tried not doing a gig for a month and come back to it?
Yes.
And how was it when you came back?
Well, I was good, but I felt the audience was a bit restrictive. No, it was bad. And even just a week, if a week goes by, I feel a bit trembly. Like I was just, you know, if my husband and I go to Italy for a week or two and I come back.
Yeah.
And do a gig at his club, the one we're sitting in right now. And I feel a bit shaky. I do. First one.
And you have to do, I'm doing some work in progress in Edinburgh just so I can just keep doing it and keep thinking. But, you know, I'll tell you, the main reason why I do it is, you know that show, there's a radio show called I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. Have you heard of that? Which is old guys. Jack D anchors it, but it's mostly guys in their 80s now do it.
All right.
And I ask people like Barry Cryer.
Sorry about this. Sorry. It's just because my phone's on.
That's okay.
Anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
And I think this is very important for people to know. This is the reason why we keep doing stand-up, because I ask them, this show's been going for 35 years. You're in your 80s. Barry Cryer, Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Garden. These are all big comedy legends. I said, why do you keep doing it? They said, Omid, you keep writing comedy because it keeps your brain sharp and your heart young. And I said, that's very true. And then they proved it. They said, you're on the list now. I said, what does that mean? It means if we ever hear a joke, which we like, we ring each other up and we tell the joke so that we share the joy and it practices joke telling.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I got a call from Barry Cryer. And I tell you what it was. He goes, Omid, Baz Cryer here. I said, yes. He goes, you know I like parrot jokes. I said, yeah, you know I like Jewish jokes. I said, I've got a Jewish parrot joke. I said, go ahead. And he did this. I'm going to try and do it the way he did it. He goes, Jewish bloke walks in a pet shop, says, I want a parrot. He goes, these ones all £5. The one at the back is £100. It's special. He goes, why? He does the Jewish prayer for the dead. And he shows him, and he says, what's this? And there's this parrot nodding backwards and forwards, going, Shamalam. He's doing all this Jewish stuff. He goes, I'll take him. He takes the parrot to the synagogue. He goes, everyone, I've got a parrot that can do the Jewish prayer for the dead. And people say, rubbish. He goes, who wants a bet? Shlomo, £50. Jaime, £20. Everyone's bated breath. He says, do it. The parrot does nothing. Everyone's, hang on, do it. And the parrot doesn't say anything. And the third time, please do it. And the parrot's shtum. The audience starts rustling, and he pays everyone out, and he's skint, and he takes the parrot home. He goes, why didn't you do the prayer when I asked? And the parrot says, Jaime, think of the odds next week. Which is a brilliant joke. And then he put the phone down. He put the phone down, and he was gone.
Yeah.
And I love.
He's got to call other people.
And then he's got a call, I think, about, of all the people done the show, probably 18 other people. But it's practice, because it keeps your brain sharp and your heart young. That's why we do it.
And you have your kids. You have three kids, I think.
Three kids, yeah.
And do they think you're funny at home? Do you make them laugh?
Yeah, I did. I always made them laugh when they were kids, and they appreciate the things. Like, I loved Asterix and Obelix books, and I used to read them and act out all the bits. And it was a bit like when Robin Williams, as a kid, said, "Dad, you don't need to do all the accents. It's fine." I was doing all that stuff, and then they went cold on me because they discovered Louis C.K. They discovered Dave Chappelle, people way better than me. And they said, you're not that good. and then with Netflix coming on, then they started watching a lot of Netflix stuff. Yeah. And then they said, actually, no, Dad, we appreciate you. You're not as bad as we thought you were. So, yeah, they appreciate me, and they appreciate that it's an income and it's a living. And it really is, what's the word? It's a vocation. It's something you have to do.
Do you think Louis C.K. should be working in the U.K. live? I don't know if you know what happened, but he had some gigs that were pulled by the producer very recently.
In England?
Yes.
Where was that?
In Sheffield. And the producer brought him over for two shows. And then there was such an uproar from other comedians on Facebook.
Really?
That he had some threats, and he pulled the shows. And so Louis is not coming over. No.
You know, it's a difficult one, this whole thing, because I got a text from management when the whole Louis C.K. masturbating in front of people, taken off the air, everything off Netflix. I got a text from my American
agent. To tell
you
to stop doing that yourself.
Yes, they said, Ahmed, we just want you to know the story with Louis has broken, and we ask you not to support him on social media.
Oh.
And if you have any skeletons in your cupboard, now is the time.
You mean your management in America sent this?
American management sent this.
About skeletons in your
cupboard? They said, if you have any skeletons in your cupboard, share them now. And I said, thank you for this text. I want you to know I'm a married man, and I masturbate at any given opportunity. When I leave the house, before a show, after a show, before a meeting, once during a meeting, when the representative Gersh went to take an emergency phone call, any given opportunity, I will do it. And then I sent it, and I waited, and then I could see them texting me. I said, dear Ahmed, thank you for your honesty. We just want you to know, as long as no one else has been involved, it's absolutely fine as far as we're concerned. Totally understandable. I wrote back, God bless America. So it was a fun, the whole thing was ridiculous to me. But at the same time, I can see, for me, the problem with the whole Louis C.K. thing was that the girls who did, the comedians who were doing it in front of, they were the ones being told, if you talk about this, we'll ruin your career. Yeah. And I think they said their careers were stopped. I think that's where it's a problem. So it's, you know, if I'm in a room with Louis C.K. because you want to see my dick, I'll say, yeah, show it to me. And if he starts jacking off in front of me, I would say, this is you being silly.
Yeah.
You're taking a joke too far now.
Yeah.
But I can see where if he's doing that in front of women and it stops their career if they talk about it, that's the problem. And
I can see that. As an LGBT performer, I don't bring it up much, but there are a lot of green rooms I don't feel safe in, verbally, and it's gone on for years.
Verbally?
Verbally.
Sorry, are you joking or are you being serious?
No, I've taken verbal abuse for years in green rooms.
From other comedians?
Yes.
Really?
And there's a producer.
For being tall and handsome? Is that what?
They're so sweet. And unfortunately, that's not what they say. And if it was, I wouldn't be mentioning this right now. But no, and particularly from this guy in Sheffield who's trolled me for a while. And
The same guy that the
somebody else. Okay. The guy who actually is going to bring Louis over is a good guy, actually, and a really fantastic producer, and a great friend to a lot of comedians. But anyway, yeah, there's been moments in my work, mostly in England and Northern Ireland, where I've thought I should probably leave now. I'm too afraid to go on stage.
Really? Really?
But I went on stage anyway, because I knew that because of the nature of my act and how I present myself and where I'm from, that I meant to take the joke.
Yeah.
I meant to see it as a joke.
Right.
And it isn't. And if it was a joke, I'd know the difference. So I know that these women felt frightened. They were terrified. And I know that their opposition to him on Facebook made sense to them. Mm-hmm. I just would rather give the audience a choice, really.
Yes. That's how
I don't like restricting anything.
Yeah, I mean, I know that it's difficult for Louis now because he did a 59 or 49-minute set recently and it went viral.
Yes. So he can't talked about it.
Yeah, he talked about it.
He's apologized for it, although not enough for some people. But yeah, he's tried to make material out of it.
What I understand also, he was doing this like the last time was like 10 years ago. Mm. Not that excuses it, but if someone has apologized, you can't, what are you going to do? Are we going to blot him out of history?
Yeah.
Because I know his Netflix specials are not on Netflix anymore.
Yeah.
I feel a little uncomfortable with that, but I do feel if anyone can come back, it's him. I know that's a thing you've probably heard before.
Yes. You know, it's odd. I went and saw him live in San Francisco a few years ago before all this happened. And his audience, the men in the audience look like him. They all look like him.
Oh, my God.
They were all kind of chubby, slightly balding ginger guys in their 40s with cute girlfriends or on their own. And he was their idol, really. And he was someone like them who they thought had made it. Do you think when you're looking out in an audience...
A lot of bald, fat women.
Yeah, do you hope that the audience is there sitting, he's like me, I get this guy? Is there a warmth that you try to create when you're on stage? Is that how you embrace them? Is there a way to bring them in that way?
I'm actually very happy to announce and tell you that I have noticed my audiences are extremely diverse. There's always an equal number of white and ethnic minority BAME audiences. So... I don't know what they find funny. I just like
BAME
to think...
BAME is, by the way, Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic.
Yes.
And it's a policy that the BBC has put forward for performers they'd like to see on their
Yeah, screen. I'll be really honest with you. When I had a BBC One TV show, it was clear to me that it wasn't because of my talent. It was because I fit a BBC remit.
Which TV show was that?
It was a BBC One show. It was called The Homage of Lily Show. It was on BBC One first, then it got moved to BBC Two. And it was just me doing stand-up and sketches. And basically, I was very well aware. It's nothing to do with when you get a TV show, you always fit a remit. And the remit then in 2007, 2008 was someone who has an ethnic minority name, Omid Jalili, but a very, very English voice. They were looking for that. It was me, Rita Chakrabarty, Zainab Badawi, ethnic name, but the voice is very English. And I used to joke that this is the reason why Trevor McDonald left the BBC because they were trying to change his name to Mamchak Bagalawawala. Anyone having it kind of thing. So I was very aware of that. And I like to think people come to my shows because the shows are funny. I don't like the idea that I'm a BAME comedian. I would like to feel that, like there's a, I'm doing an interview with Lenny Henry tomorrow, actually, about, it's a documentary for the Dave Channel about comedians of color. And my first thought was, is white not a color? Why are we, me, Black and Asian comedians, why are we color? Why is white not a color? And there was a famous joke, wasn't there? Like, white people, when you're angry, you're green. When you're embarrassed, you go pink. When you're happy, you're flushed with, So you go to lots of different colors, but Black people don't. So why is white not a color? So I've always been a bit uncomfortable with this segregation between, BAME or comedians of color, and not because why, like we call you white, why are you not, you're LGBTQ, but I mean,
plus, don't forget
plus,
the plus.
Yeah, why is that even
everything else?
I think we keep making all these differentiations.
Delineations,
I'm very uncomfortable with it because you're just piss funny. That's when I come to see you, I thought, oh, Scott's on, I'm gonna laugh. I don't think of you as a gay comedian. I hope people don't see me as, oh, he's the Iranian guy. I like to think people come and see me because I'm funny. That's all you want as a comedian.
Well, I read a lot of your commentary on Facebook for your videos.
Yeah.
And some people were saying you're a naturally born funny person. They felt that watching you.
Right.
They just said you're built as a comic, and when you're telling a story, like I've seen comedians where I can tell that when they're telling a story, they don't know where the jokes are.
Yeah,
they're either too new or they don't trust themselves enough. But when I watch you, I can tell that there's a glint, and you know where each funny bit is, which is reassuring to an audience. I wanted to play one more bit, something from your set in Montreal, about American perceptions of Iranians.
And
those perceptions must be different from British perceptions. And I think that's why this joke worked differently when you spoke about Americans in Canada. I'd like to play this if we can.
Do you know why I love you guys? Because when you see me, you don't see ethnic. You know, the Canadians, when you see me, you just see not American. And I think that's a wonderful thing. It is. It's wonderful. Because Americans are very talkative. They kind of overshare. I was in America a month ago, and first day I was there, a guy goes, hey, Omid, you know, my mom was an alcoholic. Yeah, when I was a kid, she used to put me in a box, you know, and lock it. So I don't feel too good in confined spaces. You know, also big, wide open spaces, a lot of people. I don't feel too good in my skin. You know what I'm talking about? Sorry, can you just stamp the passport and let me in? Do you mind? I haven't got time for this. It's crazy.
That's a good bit. I've forgotten
that
bit
completely.
It's really
funny, yeah. It's very funny. So do you think that American/Canadian audiences, do you deal with them in a different way when you're over there? When you're over in New York?
Yeah, I punch it up a bit, as in the sense that I just give a bit more energy. I don't know what it is. You've got to be a bit more like, woo, I'm so happy to be here. Isn't it great? Isn't life great? Woo!
I just got hair extensions. Woo! but we were in New York, Edson and I, just a few months ago, and we dropped by the club I used to play when I lived in New York in 2002-03. I didn't do a set. We just wanted to see comedy because Edson's in the business a little bit.
Caroline, where'd you go?
It was Stand Up New York, 81st and 2nd.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm sorry, the comic strip, 81st and 2nd. And we saw about 8 comics in a row because the sets are only about 7 minutes long. And they're like, woo, wow, woo. And punchline, 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 punchline. You know, you really got to hit it hard. And I know that sometimes people see me here and they're like, God, you have so many. You're a bit relentless is the word I think they've used. Friends,
yes.
Former friends have used to describe my. And I think it's because I work in the States about 4 months out of the year. And I really feel like when you're in San Francisco, LA, Seattle, New York.
It's got to be bang, bang, bang.
You have to.
Yes, exactly. People have less attention span there, I think.
Really?
I find a little bit, yeah. I find that I notice people go on their phones. If I did a bit where it needed a little bit more explanation.
Yeah.
Especially at Caroline's where they're eating, they just would get their phones.
They're eating.
I knew I was being boring, yeah.
Maybe this is your home, so you just feel on stage here like you could, like, you don't have to prove to them who you are or remind them who you are because everybody here knows.
Yes.
I feel a bit like when I'm in New York, I've got to remind them all the time of who I am, where I'm from, what I'm doing.
How well known are you in America?
In California, okay, because I do morning radio there. In the Bay Area, well known. And then, you know, if I'm in LA, I can get sets and stuff. In New York, I can get sets because I have TV credits and film credits. But the audience generally doesn't know who I am. So I have to remind them all the time. But I'm not on anything regularly there. So... really, it's a big place.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like with New York, I lived there for 2 years. The only way to do well there is to be there, really, all the time.
Yeah,
pounding
and keep doing
away,
it.
Hitting
pound
away.
Away. Yeah, I find that. That's the thing. You have to be so focused on your career, and maybe I'm not because I have a family. I find it's very hard to balance your family life, career, and quality of life, and you have to. If you let one drop, then everything gets dropped.
But when you're on a film set, do you bring the kids with you or the family with
you? No, I don't like people who do that. I don't like to do that. I keep that. Although I brought my son, because my son wants to be a director. I took him to Prague to watch the process because he wants to be a director.
Oh, right.
And he says, it's much better being a director because I watch you, Dad, in between sets. You're just practicing your bad check with the extras. Like, where do you live? I live in a flat. Do you have a dog? No. What is name of dog? I don't have a dog. Do you and dog go for walks? No. Why not? I don't have a dog. Do you have sexual relations with the dog? No. I have sexual relations with my dog, and he is okay with it. Did you have the fish for lunch? Because I heard it was off. That's the kind of conversation.
That's what you're having with him. Yeah. Let me see. I knew you had to be on your way.
No, I don't. I'm having a great time. I'm here tonight.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
I just have to go off and make some phone calls later.
It's a great club, though. So when you're...
How long is this podcast meant to be, by the way?
It's meant to be 60 minutes, but we've done about...
How long have we done?
About 60, I think. Maybe a little bit less.
Oh, should we keep going? Because there might be some things we will cut out. And if you want
yeah,
to
yeah.
I don't mind going for another 10, 15 minutes.
Great. Perfect. Thank you. Which comedians, when you first started, inspired you? I mean, because you were an actor. So
yes.
You must have seen comedy that kind of you brought into yourself through osmosis. Yes. I mean, just watching it. Who were you watching then?
The first comedian I saw at the Edinburgh Festival was Dominic Holland.
Oh, yeah.
I went to see him, and then he picked on me in the front row, and he goes, "Where are you from?" And I was living in Bratislava at the time, and I said, "I'm from Bratislava," and he said, "Where is that, Bulgaria?" And I went, "Oh, God, he's so uneducated." Because that's what it means to be a comedian, sold out, because the guy doesn't know anywhere in Europe. And I remember being really like, this should stand up should be more about it. Put some lights on, have a bit of dancing and singing. So I became a kind of like a mainstream Arab crowd pleaser. That's all I did. My whole act was like, if someone heckled me, I said, "You give me hate, I'll give you the love of Cliff Richard." And I started singing Cliff Richard songs. I'd be disco dancing because I just thought stand up was so dull.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, I've got to zhuzh this up a bit. And then it was the comedy circuit. The first few comedians were like yourself, Ricky Grover, Michael Smiley. I remember thinking Harry Hill was really funny around 96, 97. Yeah, yeah. Al Murray, Stuart Lee. I got very close to Stuart Lee and Richard Herring. I thought they were very sweet. They weren't as wild. They were quite kind of Oxford boys.
They were
a little bit more introverted off stage. So I think we all went away to Australia. You know, there was Australian things and we all bonded. So it was people like Boothby, Graffo. I gravitated towards these people. I thought they were all mentally ill.
Yeah.
And they really were. There was a guy called Parrot. Do you remember Parrot?
I remember Parrot, yeah.
Parrot
yeah.
was not bad, yeah, but yeah. I loved him. I loved these people. So I think I was influenced by all of them. That first group of comedians, Ian Stone, Mark Mayer, Ivor Dembina, all those people, I think they influenced me. And then later on, it was Bill Bailey. I remember Bill Bailey was really funny. And he also was someone who used to, he loved doing music things because... But then I'd see him do stuff that was really esoteric and quite spiritually minded. And then he'd go off and play the piano. And I said, "Bill, why did you do that?" He goes, "I thought I was losing the audience." I said, no, keep with it because it's really great. He goes, "Do you really think so?" And then I'd go and see him again. And he would follow through that esoteric comedy. Mm. And I thought, wow, maybe I can do that. Just follow through. It doesn't have to be bang, bang, bang funny all the time. So I think I was very much influenced by British comedians. And then of later on, having spent time in America, very influenced by the black comedians, because I was doing a show with Whoopi Goldberg, and there was a great comedian called, do you know Paul Mooney? You must know Paul Mooney.
Of course I know Paul Mooney.
And he was used to write for Richard Pryor. So I went to see his show.
He's an inspiration to a lot of people, a lot of younger comics.
He absolutely opened my mind to what comedy can be.
I opened for him in San Francisco a couple
did
times.
Did you really? Okay, long, good.
And so I saw him every night for seven shows sometimes.
Who's listening?
Every show is different.
Who's listening? Are mostly British people listening to this or Americans?
Both, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. They'll
know who Paul Mooney is.
If British people don't know him, Paul Mooney used to write for Richard Pryor. Is he in his 70s now?
Somewhere around there probably.
He is a viscerally funny man, but very thoughtful as well. And I remember being mind blown by him. I think he would be one of my biggest influences.
I mean, some nights 2 hours and it was all new. I was really moved watching him.
Yeah, very moved. There was one bit he said, the difference between black people and Jews, for example, if there's a Jew, like anyone here about Entebbe, they took a few Jews and they sent tomahawks, they sent people and they just blew the shit out of the place just to bring back some of their Jews. And what happens in slavery? They take us away in boats 500 years later. So people show up with a briefcase full of watches. They go fuck yourselves. I thought, Jesus.
In California, he said, "You Mexicans, you guys who work here, you better fucking watch out, right? You're on your way, you know."
Really?
They're packing your luggage for you. You can leave the burritos, motherfucker, but you got to go.
I mean, the fact that he was saying things that people were probably thinking but would never dare say. And that was my experience with Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi Goldberg was saying that because he was a writer on Whoopi. And she goes, "I want this show to be saying what people are thinking but would never dare say." And I think that was, and she was a tremendous, I was with her for a whole 9 months, and she was a tremendous, I don't know if you know her at all, but she's a real force of nature when you work with her. She's what we call Marmite in England. Some people love her, some people don't like her. I absolutely love Whoopi Goldberg because I know she was homeless in Central Park when she was a kid. She did that one show with Mike Nichols. And
amazing.
It was,
really inspired me.
I'd never seen that. You've seen that. Okay.
No, I mean the DVD and the You know, we bought it when I lived in LA and watched it 1,000 times.
Isn't it amazing? It's an amazing show. And I think that
the
heroin addict character. Incredible. She is a force of nature.
Ooh,
and she
Chocolatin. I remember that.
Yeah, you remember that.
She was in Germany.
She was a very she was a great inspiration to me because of the way she was as a performer and sticking to her guns. And also I love the way that she stood up for other comedians. Every week I would be doing stuff and they'd be giving me a very basic script. And then
was this a sketch show that you were working
it
on?
It was a sitcom called Whoopi. It was on it was actually the lead into Friends on NBC Thursday nights between 2003 and 2004. I had a deal with NBC and then obviously the tanks rolled into Iraq and I couldn't do my own show. And Whoopi said, I'll take him. So it was a hotel comedy. Actually, I don't know if I've told you, we got canceled. We did a whole 22 episodes, but they didn't renew us because of one joke. And she was told, don't push your Democrat agenda. And the joke that finished us off was hotel comedy. One week we had two events. One was a Republican meeting. At the same time, there was a lesbian wedding. And guests would arrive. They said, we're here for the Bush event. We said, could you be more specific? And that was
the joke?
That was the gag that they thought. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Can you believe it?
The TV producers, you mean?
It was NBC.
They
pulled it for that. So she'd been doing lots of Democrat jokes, but there was her third warning, and they said, that's it.
Is TV good for comedy, or I don't know.
It was a good joke to go out on.
Yeah,
I was very
but
pleased.
You know, but why siphon out the best material? Sometimes I feel like not watching your videos are great. I mean, it's different now too because everything's you know online and everything's quickly produced. And I just feel like
it was very difficult. But Whoopi gave me a very good framework about free speech, which I thought was very interesting. Because if you remember, it was Michael Richards, the guy from Seinfeld, who called someone the N-word.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a big thing in
2003. At the Laugh Factory, right?
Yeah, the Laugh Factory. And I remember asking her, it was a big question, can white people say the N-word? And Whoopi said, oh yeah, they can say the N-word, but there are going to be consequences. And I remember thinking that's it. That's, for me, the free speech bubble, if you like.
Yeah,
say
yeah.
whatever you like, but be man enough to take consequences.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
She taught me a hell of a lot, and she really had my back. And every week we'd do these things, and she'd say, come on, guys. You know, Ayatollah jokes, is that the best? This guy's an award-winning comedian from London. I want some better stuff, man. Come on. So she really had, she kept saying, I got your back, baby. I got your back. And I got very close with her, and she was very, she taught me a great lesson in authenticity, because she is an authentic artiste.
Mm.
And just the way she was, she goes, say your truth, baby. That's what you got to do. So she was very, when I did do stand up in New York, she couldn't come, but she sent friends and she goes, I heard you being authentic and that's the most important thing. And I love that. And she was so, this is Whoopi. She didn't like to fly before because I kept saying, why don't you fly, Whoopi? She goes, well, a guy died and I was in business class. A guy died on me. And I said, come on, that's not a reason to fly. She said, no, it's not. I know, there's something else. I said, you can tell me. She goes, no, I don't want to talk about it. And then she goes, motherfucker, a Cessna and a jumbo jet collided over my house and dead bodies were all over my garden. Are you happy now? I said, okay, all right, I can understand why you don't fly. Yeah. So she used to take this bus, a converted Greyhound bus, and she kept saying, she was in LA, because she traveled 2-3 days.
All right.
She goes, so you want to see my bus? I said, yeah, I'd love to see the bus. And you walk on, there's like a jacuzzi, and there's like a TiVo at the back, and there's like a gambling room. And I said to her, wow, how do you get this bus? Meaning, where do you go to get a Greyhound bus converted into a home?
Yeah, yeah.
But she heard, how do you get this bus? Like, how does a black woman in America afford this? She goes, how do I get this? Motherfucker, I make $7 million a year. How dare you? I said, no. I said, where'd you go to get it? She goes, it's a place in Queens. So she was very, because she is so viscerally authentic. She will just react straight away. And I love that about her because she was so authentic.
Yeah.
And that really taught me a big thing. And she introduced me to black culture. And that's why I started following a lot of black comedians. It was really her. I didn't know much about Dave Chappelle. She goes, have you seen the Chappelle Show? And so they used to order, like, go and get him the Chappelle Show. They'd bring me a VHS thing, and I'd watch the Chappelle Show. And it was amazing education. So I think the audience can tell.
I think that's why we like live performers so much. They can tell when you're not being authentic. I think that they'll sit and wait for a joke for a while. But if you're faking it, they really in this country
can tell. Yeah,
so there's really no point. I see comics trying to be something other than who they are. It's I'm just like, I don't know why you're bothering with this. It might be funny to you, but they're never going to like it because they know. I mean, if they want to see that, if you want to do that, do it like in a theater format or something that's more.
Yes. But the problem is, I don't know if you find this. I don't know if we should finish on this, but I'll tell you, I've learned one thing in comedy, that there is, when you're playing to the masses, you have to be very careful what you say, because if we find something funny, general, they'll laugh.
Yeah.
But if we find something like really funny where we get lightheaded when we thought about it, and I did something at home in the mirror once. I got lightheaded and I collapsed and I was laughing. I thought I was going to die. I actually lost my mind. I didn't know where I was, and I woke up about half an hour later. I literally passed out from laughing.
Right.
But I thought, I can't wait to do this on stage. And I did it and it never got a laugh. And this is the thing. It's not even a joke. It's just a bit. I guarantee you won't think it's this funny, but I thought this is the funniest thing I'd ever done. I heard that the Zimbabwean president, Robert Mugabe, people in his own language don't understand him. He's quite incoherent. So I just said, I did a little sketch to myself. I said, Mr. Mugabe, how do you answer accusations that you're getting more and more incoherent? And Mugabe says, la, 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 la! And the thing was, I collapsed. And I tried that, and the audience didn't laugh. And I tried it again other nights, like different, like, la, 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 la. But it had to be those sequence of notes that made me laugh, but it never translated. So I always do that at new material nights, saying, I'd like to give you a warning. You may not laugh because things that I think are piss funny never gets a laugh. And then that gets them people kind of think, okay, that wasn't funny, but what have you got? So
I have rehearsed shows that were scripted on paper, and word for word, I got it right. And then I put that in front of an audience. Nothing.
Nothing.
Then I go away for a couple of days. I calm the fuck down. I let myself off the ledge. I remind myself I'm not important. I loosen the leash a bit.
Yes.
Because I've got to get it so right, because I'm a double Sag, Gemini rising. It's all got to be perfect and wordy and because I'm, you know. Anyway, I remind myself that there's an audience there. It's not a seminar. It's a conversation. And when I go back and do that, it works a little bit better.
And in answer to your question about that performance for Prince Charles' 70th birthday, I had got to that point where I had actually been told, comedy's not that important. You're not that important. Your ideas are not that important. And in fact, I'm going to finish my TED talk with Omid Jalili, ideas not worth sharing, because it's all about ideas worth sharing. And it, actually, that's what we are, comedians who are telling ideas that are not worth sharing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I totally lost any kind of fear, because I thought, this isn't important. And actually, in years to come, no one's going to forget about this. But actually, I secretly looked at the numbers on YouTube. That's got 1.5 million views in a couple of months.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy that this moment you stop caring, that's when you become more successful.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to tell yourself.
Yeah,
it's not that important.
Well, the first Edinburgh Fringe I did well.
94?
I had no expectations. I didn't know what it was.
You won Best Newcomer.
I did. And I just showed up with a duffel bag and a jar of
And a
Vaseline.
Rag bag of
Yeah. And prayed for the best.
Was that your opening joke?
Thank you so much.
Listen, man, thank you so much. We would just get going. I'm just keep talking just so you can...
Are you national touring soon?
No, I'm going to stop. I'm stopped right now.
All right. Thank you. And next week, I don't know what the title of the show will be or who the guest will be. But
how was it with Andrew Doyle? Did you ask him about free speech and why?
I mentioned your comment and he laughed. And he said, I'm kind of just thrilled that he knows who I am. I said, well, he does. And we're all worried about you. So, yeah, we got on with it. He did really well.
He's a funny guy. He writes for Jonathan Pye, doesn't he?
Yes, he used to. And he's doing great. I'm really happy for him.
Because
he's a good friend of mine and he struggled for a long time on the circuit. It's hard.
But you'd never seen that clip of him throwing people out.
I'd heard about it.
Okay.
But then we played it on the show. We did play it. And he was like, well, this is what happened. And he got a bit like, well, you know, you don't know what happened. And I'm like, well, it's just funny.
No, I'm sure it was bad.
He kicked four people out. And someone threw a drink on him. And
Yeah, and that's bad. You should know, you can't throw a drink on someone when there's a microphone because that could electrocute.
It's really dangerous. Yeah. I had to lift a woman in Edinburgh physically. I mentioned this when he was talking about his thing. I had to pick her up and throw her out because she came
you
at me.
Tried her
to,
up.
Oh, I did. I put my hands in her armpits and lifted her. And brought her out and put her on the... She was so drunk and tried to get the mic out of my hand. And oh, blah, blah, blah. But anyway.
Sometimes that happens. I was in Reading once and I came out and I said, good evening, Reading. And this woman starts shouting, shut up about Reading. All you do is go on about Reading, Reading, Reading. I'm sick to death. And the bloke next to her got up and left. And then all throughout the show, she was heckling me. And at halftime, security said, it's okay, we've dealt with it. She's just some woman who's a bit of a nutbag. I said, who was the guy who left? He goes, that was a carer. And they said, why did he leave? He goes, once she gets like that, I can't handle it. I said, you're supposed to handle it.
That's your job. The
That's
show has just
job.
Started.
He just got up and left.
Well, thank you, and good luck tonight.
Thank you so much. It's going to be great. I'm practicing my TED Talk tonight. It's the TED Talk. They want a TED comedy set, but something with a bit more. Like, they want something thoughtful.
Something a narrative. Self-reflective. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Great talking to you.
You too. Oh, hi there. If you want to find this podcast on Twitter, you probably already have. But if you haven't, it's at Scott Cupuro, ScottCapuro. It's the same address on Facebook, where I'll hopefully be downloading this podcast, and all over social media. So take care and see you next week. Thanks. Bye.